Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Franz Kashuk, ACM Infosys Foundation Award $150,000 recipient in 2011, internationally renowned MIT professor, researcher and scientist, innovating entrepreneurial company founder and executive. Franz, you have a considerable award-winning history of notable distinction and significant outstanding contributions as a scientist, researcher, innovator, and entrepreneur. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Thank you for having me.
Franz, it's just a remarkable achievement, your latest award. Now, when did you hear about this extraordinary honor, that is the recipient of the ACM Infosys Foundation Award? How did you feel at the time, and what was the reaction of your colleagues and from your family?
I heard about it when, actually, on vacation, at a ski vacation in Italy, and I got a call early in the morning from the chair of the committee informing me that I had received this award, which took me by complete surprise. In fact, took me a couple minutes into the conversation before I actually realized that that I was actually selected for the award rather than just nominated for the award, which I first thought. Yeah, so it was a huge surprise, and pleasant surprise, I may say so.
And then the reaction of your colleagues and from your family?
I was sworn to secrecy, and so I actually didn't tell anybody until it was officially announced. And then the response was overwhelming, and everybody was very, very excited for me, and it was delightful.
Well, it very much demonstrates the historical impact and continuing impact that you have on the world and in computer science. How will you use the $150,000 prize?
I have no idea. At least I haven't really thought much about it. I guess I'm from a Dutch Calvinistic background, and I guess you don't start spending money until you have it. And so the official ceremony, I think, is in June, at which point the prize will be handed out, and I will start thinking about what to do with it. But I'll probably try to do something special with it related to computer science.
Now, in our audience, we have a number of young people, students and so on, who are pursuing different kinds of careers, including into computing. So I know that describing your journey can act as sort of a mentoring sort of feeling to these students. Now, so can you describe your journey to computing from your youth up to the present? Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. I guess I have sort of a classic, sort of journey. I fell in love with programming early on in the early grades of high school, and I was always fascinated by programming. I didn't realize that actually you could, at that point, you could make a career out of it or even do research in it. And so when I went to college, I was unclear what I was going to do, probably something with science and engineering, but I had no idea really what, and everything seemed exciting, whether it was physics or math. But then at some point I had to make a decision about what to major in, and I said, I like programming a lot. Why don't I just go do computer science? And then at least I can do a lot of programming. And so that's sort of the start of getting involved in the whole computer science business and going in the computer science direction.
Now, in this sort of journey that you've been on, then what foundational lessons can you share?
I think the main thing I would share is that, try to follow your heart and your interests, and it will lead you into interesting directions that you might not have anticipated. But generally it will work out well. If you don't do something that you really like, it's very hard to get excited and spend the energy necessary to actually do good work.
So when you look around the world, then whose work inspires you?
So I was greatly inspired, I guess, with people that built large software systems and actually were able to make them work and innovate at the same time. And that seems like a unique property of computer science, where there's such a enormous pace of innovation, and being able to participate in that is hugely exciting. And there's so many people around in computer science that do continuously very exciting stuff. So it'd be hard to single out a single person I think it's more, you know, the field as a whole that really got me very excited and, you know, admire, you know, the progress of the large group of people that are doing both in industry as well as in academia, just fantastic work. You can just see what kind of impact it has on the society. I mean, just changes from day to day and, you know, things that were unknown a couple of years ago now are, you know, common good and everybody's using them. And so that's just tremendous.
So in your journey, have you had any mentors?
Yeah, I had a couple of people that were hugely influential. I think most importantly, my PhD advisor, Andy Tannenbaum, who took me under his wing and guided me and taught me how to do computer systems research. So I entered college as a computer science student. I didn't really know whether I wanted to do sort of theoretical computer science or computer systems. I didn't have a good appreciation that, you know, you could do serious research, scientific research, if you were going in the direction of building computer systems and computer system engineering, and which involves a lot of programming. I always thought that's a great hobby, that's a fun thing to do. It was not clear to me that, you know, you could do actually serious research in that. And I think Andy Tannenbaum just really showed me how actually to do research and got me started on that path. Otherwise, I probably would have done something else.
So perhaps for the benefit of the audience, and especially those who aren't familiar with Tannenbaum's work, maybe you can describe some of it.
Oh, yeah. Andy Tannenbaum is an American, but he teaches in the Netherlands, where I went to the college. And he is very well known for a number of textbooks in computer networking, operating systems, and distributed systems. And these are textbooks that are all used all over the world. He also was co-developer of Minix, which started the Minix project, which had a huge influence on other, you know, open source operating systems. And so he's a widely known person, and it was, for me, it was a tremendous opportunity to be able to work with him.
Now, how did you end up at MIT?
After I finished my PhD, I was looking around for doing actually a postdoc somewhere in the United States. In fact, I wanted to go to grad school in the United States early on, but Andy Tannenbaum convinced me to actually stay in the Netherlands. And so after I finished, I really wanted to go to the United States. And so I was talking to several people in the field and saying, like, what should I do? And they said, why don't you actually apply for faculty positions? And I said, well, that seemed to me like a pretty reasonable idea. So actually I did, not expecting to actually get any interviews nor to get any offers, but I actually ended up getting a bunch of interviews and subsequently a number of offers, including one from MIT, and then ended up going to MIT.
Now, you know, MIT is world famous, so you have sort of an insider or kind of viewpoint. So can you describe the environment at MIT from an inside perspective?
Sure. MIT is It's indeed a unique place, and I think partly because almost everybody is excited about doing, you know, science and engineering. Wherever you go, whoever you talk to, people have great interest in, even if it's not a project they immediately are working on, but they will ask, you know, questions about, oh, so why are you doing this? Why are you not doing this? And there's a very vibrant community of building things and having interest in what other people are building, asking tough questions, and trying to figure out, like, what is the right answer. And, you know, MIT is very much about doing it the right way and trying to figure out what the right way is. And so that makes it a very stimulating environment.
I noticed in looking at your background, you're also deeply connected with the ACM, the IEEE, and so on. So why do you participate in those societies?
There's several reasons. You know, the ACM is the sponsor of many of the major conferences in computer science, and the moment, and these conferences generally are the top conferences in the field, and so it's very important, you know, that there is a healthy set of conferences, you know, for being able to move the computer science field forward. And so as a, you know, participant in those conferences, you know, the supporting the ACM is an important thing to do.
Well, that's amazing. And I noticed you were named an ACM fellow in 2004, so that's quite an honor in itself.
Yeah, that was another surprise, and another welcome surprise.
Now, how would you describe your top three innovative achievements in terms of what specifically inspired these innovations? What were the factors that made the innovations possible? The problems you're trying to solve, your solutions, and the impact it has today and into the longer-term future?
That's a whole set of questions at the same time. And let me try to break it down a little bit. I think when actually you're working on a particular problem, you don't never really know whether that is going to be the one that's going to make the most impact, or it's going to be the one that will be talked about in the research community. I think in general, you just work on what you think is a hard and distinct problem that you don't understand how to solve, and you try to solve it. And in some cases, it turns out that there's a huge interest in it. And so, and the problems come from different directions. You know, sometimes it's a problem, an intellectual question. You know, you're curious, could you build a system in a different way, which I think is, for a large part, what drove the exokernel project, which is one of the three ones that ACM cited in the nomination. The other one is on distributed hash tables, which I actually thought about quite a bit in the context of a company that I was working on, where we didn't have to solve that particular problem, but it seemed to me that outside of the commercial space, it would be an interesting problem to solve. So because this is of course a very hard problem, and it took us a while to solve it. So that was the other problem case. The third case is on decentralized information flow control for operating systems. And that was really motivated by the fact that, you know, there are so many computer security break-ins because of bugs in software, that the question was, could you design an operating system in a way that even if you had bugs in the applications, that it would still be impossible that information would leak. And that might, you know, that seems just like a very hard problem. And so we spent a bunch of time working on that problem. So that's sort of at a very high level how we got to these different problems. In terms of impact, you know, a lot of the few, almost none, I think, of these projects actually have direct, you know, measurable commercial impact on a product. They can just point to say, like, you know, our code that we wrote as a prototype got moved over directly into a product. But typically, you know, the impact has been through the papers that describe the ideas. And in some cases, people have adopted the ideas directly. In other cases, you know, people just build forward on that set of ideas. And so the impact is generally much more indirect as opposed to direct. And in fact, most of the research that I've done is, in some sense, not very visible, you know, to end users. None of the work is really into applications. It's all much more in the infrastructure that sits, you know, below the applications. I'm just checking if I checked off all your four or five sub-questions here. But I think I did.
yeah, absolutely. So that was good. Now, you know, it's really quite interesting, you know, your innovative achievements, and you've got this great history of research. And so can you profile some of your future research, its challenges and opportunities and implications?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so the two problem areas that I'm currently working on, and in collaboration, of course, with colleagues and students, as well as with all the previous work, the two problem areas are, one, multi-core operating systems, and two, additional work in the area of computer security. And so the first one, as you probably well know, and your listeners well know, the number of cores per chip is increasing, and that means that applications need to be parallel, and that also means that the operating system has to be parallel, because a lot of parallel applications like mail servers that run inside of data centers are inherently parallel, but they use the operating system a lot. And so if the operating system wouldn't scale well with the number of cores, then those applications wouldn't get good performance. And so if we've been thinking a lot and understanding a lot what it means for an operating system to be scalable and how you design operating systems so that they are scalable. That's one direction. The second direction that we've been looking at is additional computer security work. The previous work that I mentioned on decentralized information flow control focused a lot on confidentiality, you know, making sure that information doesn't leak. The current direction I'm focusing on in collaboration with my colleagues, and in particular Nikolai Zeldovich, is on computer system integrity. And with that I mean ensuring that the system just operates correctly even if the computer system gets compromised. So the scenario is let's say you have a desktop, 3 weeks after an attack, you discover that your machine was compromised. How do you recover the system in a way that basically you lose all the work or you lose all the effects of the adversary or the attacker, but keep all the work that you have done in those last 3 weeks? And so we have a plan based on selective undo to be able to recover systems after an attack.
Now, Franz, you have an entrepreneurial sort of component of your work, and I know you founded a couple of companies, for example, or you're part of the founding of it. So, let's kind of drill into that a little bit further. So can you describe the journey from initial startup, obtaining investment, managing the ventures, conducting the research, and then finally the acquisition for the commercial ventures that you've founded and what you've learned from this process?
There were two companies that I was directly involved in founding. And the first one, or actually both of them, in some sense all started accidental. It was not that we actually had the intent to found a company. And we were just doing the research, and at some point, people stop by at MIT all the time and ask, could you, what are the commercial applications of this, and whatnot? And so, in that light of that context, I started thinking about some problems that might be actually applicable and that might have more direct applicable commercial impact. And I got excited about them and sort of went off and talked to, with colleagues to the VC community and see how they resonated. And we got pretty positive feedback. And so we said, let's go ahead and start a company. How these companies developed, one went very fast. The other one took a much, much, much longer time. And, that's doing a startup is a strange journey in general. I think it's a challenge because you don't really know what is going to happen. Every day feels like there's a big problem that needs to be addressed because otherwise the next day the startup won't be there anymore. But it's usually exciting. And I think it's very hard to plan to make a startup successful. What you try to do is just try to make sure that you solve some customer's problem well and hope that, there are many more customers like that customer and just keep working on it. I don't think I never believed in the sort of the goal of like doing a startup so to get it to be acquired. The only thing I think you can do is try to build a viable company that can stand on its own feet and, just see where it goes.
I'm sort of curious then, when you do a startup, did you have to pitch the startup to the venture capital community or angel community to get some initial seed capital?
Yes, we did. And one of my co-founders, Gifford, already had done a previous company, and so he had quite a bit of context already with the VC community. And together we went off and pitched the idea and worked with the VC community to sharpen up the pitch and start the company.
So do you have some recommendations on that process of doing the pitch, sharpening that pitch? And
it turns out that I think all the experience of just writing papers and giving talks on research ideas is really helpful. Giving a good talk or writing a good paper is a difficult thing to do. It's something you need to learn. But once you get good at it, then the doing a VC pitch is not much different. You basically have to be able to express very concisely what your idea is, how it relates to other ideas, and why your idea is an advancement over the current state of art and has large potential. And being able to articulate those ideas well and succinctly is the key to, I think, getting VC funding, other than, of course, just having a good idea. So in some sense, it's not actually that different than writing up a research paper that explains what your new idea is and why it's a good idea and why it's an advancement of the state of the art. Now, clearly, in the case of a company, you need to make an argument why there's a market for it, which is, of course, never the case in a research paper. But the general style of and the general experience of actually being able to articulate an idea is just as important in either case, whether you're starting pitching to the VCs or whether you're actually teaching a class or whether you're actually writing a paper.
I see. So you'd have become quite experienced at refining a business plan.
I think, you know, most of the ideas that we worked on were not ideas that were an existing market. And so we were betting on betting on markets that were not currently existing, but hopefully would come about. And that's a high risk strategy. But of course, if the market materializes, you know, then you're the leader in the market, and that puts you in an excellent position. Or maybe you're one of the two early leaders in the market, and either one is going to be doing fine. And so the business side is not so complicated, in the sense that you don't really have to study very carefully an existing market, because, you know, the existing market actually doesn't really apply directly to what you're actually proposing. So I have always done startups that are try to aim at new markets as opposed to trying to do better than somebody that is already in the market.
And then what's the process like when you finally get acquired? I mean, do the companies approach you, or are you soliciting companies, or how does that work?
So as I said before, I don't really believe in sort of targeting acquisition. And so that actually happens more the other way around, that indeed other companies approach you. And, you know, typically these are companies that are either a customer or are in a market that is parallel, you know, to the market you're working in, and, you know, are interested in broadening their product portfolio. And typically in both cases, the way it works is they approached us as opposed to the other way around.
And then how do you put a valuation on your company?
You have bankers that get involved, and yeah, they help you in the whole process of the acquisition. And of course, the senior management team is involved in that process too. But that's a complicated, you know, the process with a discussion between the acquirer, the acquiree, and et cetera.
Now, you have a lot of research. You've been out there for some time. You have a great reputation. Do you have new commercial ventures in mind for your current or future research?
I know. At this point, not right now. Mazu finished, or the acquisition really finished last year. And much of the current research I'm doing is not so much a standalone product. It seems like it would be much better embedded in, you know, existing products. And so the path to commercializing this is probably not, you know, through a startup, but actually working with companies that are already in this space.
Now, over your distinguished career, what are the top lessons that you want to share with the broader audience?
I think the most important one is just follow your heart. You have to be very excited and passionate about something. And if you are, then if you can find something that you're very passionate about, then you know, it's much easier to work your way through the down points and, you know, the whatever disappointment you might run into, and keep going. I think both in doing startups and in doing research, one thing that's important is to actually be able to be persistent. And if you like what you're doing, it's much easier to be persistent.
Now, right now you're 46. So where do you see yourself at 55 and at 65?
I have no idea. I'm not a person that actually thinks ahead very much. In general, I don't think I had more than a couple of years. So I have no idea where I would be at that time.
So where do you see yourself in a couple of years?
Hopefully solving one of these two problems I'm currently working on, and see if we can turn that into something exciting.
Now, if you could sum up your life experiences for career tips for the working sort of ICT professionals outside of academia, what would be your tips, the reasons behind them?
For people outside of academia?
Yes, that's correct.
So, be good at what you do. And if you're very good at something, people will recognize it, and you will make impact.
Now, Franz, you're internationally respected for your research as this renowned professor and scientist and researcher. So, in a way, I guess you're ideally situated to make predictions about their future and their implications and how people can best prepare.
As I said before, I'm not a big believer in predictions, because mostly they're wrong, and it's very hard to predict, as you well know, to predict the future. But in particular, I think in the area of computer science, where, you know, the field just moves so tremendously, you know, partly driven by, you know, technology, rapid improvement in technology, partly because there are new applications that suddenly emerge, and so it's very hard to make any serious predictions about what will happen in computer science in the next couple of years, other than something exciting will happen. So how do you plan for this? I think, you know, you try to plan for by picking out, you know, problems that you think are hard, and trying to make sure that at least you're good at something and that you can contribute, you know, in that way.
Do you ever think that we'll get to this point of things like Kurzweil's singularity?
I'm not 100%. What do you mean by that?
Sort of this merging of humans and computers, and, you know, people just sort of living forever and just
might be, might not be. I don't know. I think there are many intermediate problems that are very exciting and hard to solve that maybe get us in that path in the longer direction. But I'm more focused on these more immediate problems that clearly, you know, may be in reach of solving.
Now, more broadly, including computing, but even outside of computing, what do you see as the top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
I think I guess I have sort of a limited view of the world, and I mostly look at things from an academic research perspective. And it seems to me there's a broad array of, you know, exciting problems that need to be solved and that are not solved yet. And I wouldn't want to pick out one single one and saying, like, this is the one that we should be solving. I think there's a huge opportunities in sort of the intersection of computer systems and sensors and connecting, you know, every device in the world to the networks. And which I guess is sometimes called by the term cyber physical systems. The other hand, I think there are tremendous opportunities and interesting problems in the area of computer security. You know, if every device actually is going to be connected to the internet, you know, that seems we need to get much better at computer security than we currently are. But yet another, you know, there are other directions that are very promising too. You know, we need to get better at actually writing software than we currently are. And, you know, any of these problems areas are need a lot of work.
Now, we've explored different topic areas in this interview. So if I were to sort of turn the tables, what questions would you have asked, and then what would be your answers?
I think the main question I would ask is, you know, why is computer science so exciting? And I think my answer would be that, unlike many other fields, things in computer science change at a much more rapid rate. And then that makes the field incredibly vibrant, incredibly exciting, and easy to jump into.
Well, that's fascinating. I guess really what you're doing too is you're sort of saying to the sort of the broader public, get involved in some way.
Well, absolutely. This is going to be, I think, you know, computer science is basically, you know, if you want to think about it, is at the beginning of the industrial revolution. We're at this stage, sort of at the beginning of the industrial revolution equivalent of computer science. And so that's going to be very, very exciting in the next, you know, couple of decades.
You know, I can feel your passion about computers and computer science in this interview. So what is your passion outside of computing, and what is your favorite device?
What is my favorite device? Maybe a bike. I like biking, and I like playing squash. So,
well, that's interesting. So I was expecting some sort of gadget.
you know, I like computers, but, you know, and I play with computers all the time, and I program computers all the time. But, you know, I feel like that's, you know, currently my work hobby / hobby. So I don't have a particular favorite, you know, computer science gadget.
Well, you know, I really enjoyed this interview, and I know your schedule's pretty tight. So, you know, we're really fortunate to have you come in to do this interview, and we'll continue to watch your work as it reverberates through history.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Franz Kashuk, ACM Infosys Foundation Award $150,000 recipient in 2011, internationally renowned MIT professor, researcher, and scientist, innovating, entrepreneurial, company founder, and executive.